Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values, the ideas that shape us, and the humans behind the positions in our public conversations. Each episode, I speak to someone involved in public debates in some way, and I ask them about what they hold sacred and what they've learned about engaging across difference. In divided times, we hope that listening to a wide range of perspectives on religion, politics, identity, and more will help us grow in empathy. If you listen long enough, you should hear someone you disagree with, perhaps strongly, but I hope you'll also feel like you've deepened your understanding of those involved in shaping our common life. As always, please do rate, review, and share the podcast. It really helps. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Ed West. Ed is a journalist, and he's worked on Nuts magazine, The Catholic Herald, and as a columnist for The Telegraph and The Spectator. He's currently deputy editor at Unheard, and the author of a recent book called Small Men on the Wrong Side of History, about conservatism. I really hope you enjoy listening. Ed, you have not had enormous amount of warning about this question due to an organisational blip, but I will ask you about what you hold sacred, and you can feel the space created by that hefty word, however you like. It's really a way of opening up early on a little bit of space for self-reflection, a little bit of space to have a think about what are the deep principles that you've tried to live by. We try and bracket out, obviously, kind of family, those sort of obvious things that we'd all share. And one way of getting to it is that kind of disgust response, that sense of ugh, where you feel like you might be being compromised by something that often can get to something that we hold sacred. But really, you can take the conversational baton and take it wherever you like.
I don't know. Interesting question. I suppose as I got older, I've become more sensitive to that sort of sense of disgust, which I think we all have in it. I mean, I suppose if it depends if it's something's on an intrinsic like gut level or whether it's on a sort of higher principle. I do very much believe in not going out of one's way to insult, you know, other people's traditions or other people's sacred values. And this can sound very boring, middle of the road, but especially as, you know, we live in a more sort of globalized world, it's very easy to do that because there are so many different traditions we have to hold. And I suppose in a sort of very wet way, my thing, which is I really dislike the way everyone is, a lot of people are very rude and think it's clever. And I think that's been very much influenced by the social media thing, which has sort of gotten worse, where unkindness, and especially if it's sort of people outside of your sort of in-group, is sort of so normalized. And it seems to have got so much worse this year, especially influenced by America, sort of almost normalization of first sort of violent language against people, then violence against property, and I think inevitably violence against people. And so I have a very strong aversion to any, I suppose you would, what in early modern terms we'd sort of call it enthusiasm, you know, that in the religious sense, I very have a strong aversion to that. I suppose moderation and lightness would be my sacred values. I know that sounds almost liberal democrat of me, doesn't it?
I'd love to hear a bit about your childhood. Give a sense of what are the things that have formed you, particularly any big ideas, whether those are political or philosophical or religious. Kind of what was in the air when young Ed was running around?
I suppose, firstly, I mean, I was very much a product of the Cold War, and that was like a central thing going on because both my parents were journalists and they were involved with that in various ways. My dad was a foreign correspondent and been in Vietnam, and I remember being in Nicaragua when I was a child, and I mentioned that in the book. And I suppose communism was this overwhelming, menace. I don't know, not menace in everyday life. I don't woke up thinking as an 8-year-old worrying about communism. But I mean, they did take me to East Germany, which is in retrospect quite a weird thing to do. So I was very, I suppose that made me very aware from an early age that the modern world was not necessarily better than the past. But, you know, communism came along and it replaced these old empires run by the Habsburgs and other people, and communism had made things a lot more worse. It made the people poorer, maybe got unhappier, it had worse architecture. So I suppose that definitely influenced my worldview. So I never sort of grew up thinking everything always gets better and better. So yes, that was the first thing.
And were your parents, did they have kind of sympathies towards communism? Did they have some, you know, were they kind of politically peggable as well as journalists?
My mum was a sort of former feminist who became a sort of conservative Catholic from Ireland. And I remember she was involved in these various Polish Catholic charities, which are obviously anti-communist. So there's a particular Polish aspect. My dad was a very communist when he was younger, but in a sort of public school way. He had become very reactionary, like madly reactionary by the time I was a kid, like maddeningly so. You know, sort of everything's better in the 14th century, blah, blah, blah. Democracy is a mistake. The Reform Act was terrible. We should have Rothenburghers. Although I didn't know if it was a joke or not. And I never knew of my dad. Everything was sort of half a joke. But no, he thought communism was generally very evil. But he also didn't really like Thatcher's sort of brand of conservatism, which I didn't really understand as a child. He thought, you know, this is not really what conservatism is about. They're selling stuff off, you know, we should support railways. You know, it's privatization. The market is not necessarily conservative. And these kind of things I didn't really think about as until I was much older. I suppose because I was brought up in the sort of that kind of Thatcherite worldview vaguely, and I sort of just assumed that was the way forward. And then everyone seemed to be getting richer in the 80s, and in comparison, sort of 70s, it all seemed a bit, you know, sort of rubbish and run down. And that was something that I sort of challenged as I got older and realized it wasn't that simple. But yeah, I suppose so it was a kind of slightly bohemian conservative background, you know, very, my parents had all sorts of cranky friends and, you know, royalists and people in favor of bringing back all sorts of strange things. And, you know, we went to St. Etheridas. I mentioned in the book Father Charles Roux, who wanted Marie Antoinette canonized. He had this great campaign. He put his stamps upside down and all his in France because he didn't recognize what he called the regicide state. So there's, you know, that was, quite reactionary, I suppose.
Yeah. And like many kind of teenagers growing up in that environment would react against that by, you know, becoming quite left wing or, you know, going to the opposite extreme. But from your book, it sounds like you never did that, that you've just been sort of solidly, strongly conservative leaning really all the way through.
Pretty, yeah, pretty much so. I mean, I mentioned in the book that I suppose I wasn't that political as a teenager, but people who aren't political are basically default conservative. I mean, there's even research of people who don't consider themselves political, their values are basically the same as conservatives. So that is almost like the default state of people. I suppose my parents were very easygoing with me. They didn't tell me to do anything really so much. We were very relaxed as children. But I did, you know, I mentioned in the book, I was influenced by the fact that I went to a school in central London and it was comprehensive. It was a good comprehensive, it was like grant maintained. I think it was one of the top ones in London. But it was very much a kind of Hobbesian world where there are, you know, a lot of rough kids in this school who would beat the hell out of me if they're given the chance. But it was a very, very well-ordered and sort of slightly authoritarian school. And it did very well in that. And this was a time in education. A lot of schools at the time were the opposite. They were sort of experimenting with sort of radical ideas about child-centered education influenced by Rousseau. The school down the road was Holland Park Comprehensive. And that was, you know, there's a socialist Eton where kids could not wear uniforms and have to do homework and did as much work as they want to. And it sort of ended in this, when I was there, that ended as a sort of dystopian. I mean, it was like early 80s New York, you know, the Warriors or something. It was sort of a terrifying nightmare place by all accounts. And they sort of chased us down the road and everything. But so I suppose that also influenced my politics, you know, because fear sort of goes hand in hand with conservatism if you see the world as essentially a dangerous place.
I want to hear a bit more about Catholicism and where that comes from in your family and kind of what was the lived experience of it when you were young? What was the practice? How did you, I always sort of I always feel awkward asking about God, about the G-bomb, more so than I think people's sex lives. But, you know, how present was God to you as a child, if at all?
So we raised as Catholics because, I don't know, I suppose it's just, I mean, there was partly because the Catholic Church is more forceful about that. But we weren't forced to go to church beyond quite an early age. And I could understand, but I didn't empathize with people who had this, you know, hugely strict religious upbringing where, you know, the priest says everything, it goes, and, you know, I'm so scared of God and the church, and I want to rebel against it, because it was never like that for me. Christianity was already quite a weakened force. And I just never saw it as oppressive. I mean, even as a teenager, I remember thinking I didn't really want to take part in this, but I can see it's, you know, it's good for other people. And I mean, that sounds really boring. I just wish I could, you know, it'd be nice to be able to rebel, but I didn't really feel like oppressed by it in any.
It was sort of in the background, it sounds like.
It was in the background, yeah. I mean, the problem is, you know, the church we went to, I won't name it, but the wider Catholic church in England that we were sort of part of was, you know, it was very much that very dour Irish Jansenist tradition, which I find very off-putting. It's a very sort of unjoyous religious experience. And I know, I always thought it has some of the worst aspects of both Catholicism and Protestantism. It's kind of Calvinistic and it's pessimism and but it has terrible singing. So you get just every aspect of that. And we just, as children, remember being bored and just looking around at all the old people who, and this sort of influenced my ideas about politics later, they were just so sanctimonious, and it was like a competition to see who could be the most miserable and therefore the most pious among them. And I suppose as I got older, I felt that sanctimony, I sort of saw it in people's politics as well, and that sort of really put me off the left, even quite an early age. And I think that's probably happening a bit now more amongst particularly young men, especially in America. The whole, as we have now, as it becomes much, much more sanctimonious, it's just really off-putting, people, that feeling of being around people who sort of think they're morally better than you. So yeah, that definitely influenced my politics later. But, you know, we came from a mixed family, but I mean, it was much more divided. The religious divide, you know, was much more about ethnic divides, I think, you know, the Irish English historical thing, but with a religious overlap as well. My religious beliefs have always been sort of vague, and, you know, I would like to say I was, you know, a strong believer, but I've always been philosophical about it, in the sense that I don't really have any choice in this matter, and I don't think I'm ever going to know. But I do think this is, I mean, this sounds really cynical and people are going to hate it, but it's sort of Pascal's thing, you know, this is the right thing to do. And when it comes down to it, I am a great, you know, I don't believe in revolutions, but I think the only successful revolution there has ever been is the Christian revolution. And this comes down to, you know, Tom Holland's book about how Christianity changed things. And, you know, in my heart, I've always believed that's the right thing, and that's changed us for the better. And, you know, if this tells us something about ourselves as people, then that, I think this is a thing worth following. So, you know, I can't say I've had some huge Damascene moment, but I do think it's a tradition with truth that I would like to sort of follow and you know, hopefully impart a little bit to my children. Although, you know, that is very hard in a very secular world.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that responsibility is one I really wrestle with. So you had two journalist parents, and I think you also have a journalist brother. So it sounds like it was just a sort of an obvious path. One of the things I found funny looking at your CV is just the diversity of journalism jobs you've done. And there can't be many people in the country who has worked at both the Catholic Herald and Nuts magazine and written books related to both of those areas of thoughtfulness. Talk to me about that. What, you know, is that just different parts of yourself, different strands? What was the thread you were pulling on?
Well, after university, I just did work. I just applied for work experience at different magazines. And the first one that came back was, the first one I did was Maxim, you know, another lad's magazine. I mean, they're all closed now because crushed by the internet. But so I did that. So I started there, and I ended up doing about 5 years in lads mags, rather than going in sort of, you know, newspapers conventionally. Which was, I mean, it was fun. It was fair. I mean, the main was Nuts, which was sort of a massive thing at the time. It was fun. It was very obvious. There's some lovely people there. I mean, the people who worked there were the absolute opposite of what you imagine. Landmark people were. They were all sort of very thoughtful, centre-left English graduates who like listening, reading The Guardian and wanted to work for The Guardian. And then, but it was all this, we used to have this joke that, you know, the editor was this guy, Phil, was really nice, you know, he likes jazz and drinking nice bottles of red wine. He had two children in his North London house home, and he has to give us his talk about how we're all bloody blokes and it's all about being a bloke and having football and birds and stuff. And we used to just joke, a friend and I, that, you know, after this, he'd just come home at night and put his head in his hands and cry by the fire. And then years later, he wrote an article for The Independent, and that was pretty much, we were bang on. It was just, you know, it's me that everyone is sort of living a complete lie about what they're actually like, sort of selling a dream to other people.
That's terrifying, Ed. The sense of, how many of these outlets that are selling a real worldview and a lifestyle, it's just entirely fake. What do you think was driving it?
Well, it's funny because the original men's magazines, we were in the same company as Loaded. The monthly ones were really like that, and a lot of the writers were very hedonistic. But a lot of them got into real trouble with drugs and stuff, and they were quite rock and roll. But it's like everything, sex. Once sex starts selling, it becomes commodified, and companies get involved, and marketing people become involved, and becomes much more cynical. So, you know, Nuts even started when I was there. I was very pleased. He said, "Oh, we won't have nipples because we want to it's obviously sexist by today's standards." I say today, isn't it? 20 years ago. But then it became more and more pornographic because the marketing people said, "Oh, you know, this is what young people like. This is what young men like." And it was kind of a good example of how, you know, if you do make things like this a commodity, then the market will inevitably push them in a more extreme direction because to make more money. And it will also become false. So it wasn't, I mean, strangely, because like lots of people, it wasn't really my scene at all. And I think I left there when I was 25. Yeah, to go freelance and for a bit. And then, was I 27? Yeah, so that was, I mean, it's such a strange because culture's shifted so much and so much of the content now and so much of the culture of even the early 20s would be so unacceptable even 10 years later. Huge difference in culture.
Yeah. And how much, obviously, I mean, you might have been oblivious to it, but I can't help but pop psychologize you in terms of, you know, you left Nuts magazine and a particular culture and then a few years later you were married with children and joining the Conservative Party. Was there an internal struggle around it? Were you uncomfortable? Are there things you regret, or kind of sliding off you?
No, I didn't. I felt uncomfortable, and I regret it really. I think loads of people would do that. Because it was quite squalid, and it was quite common for people who worked there in those places to write afterwards about, "Oh, I'm told, so you know, we're exploiting women," and. And we were, definitely. I mean, we were exploiting people who thought they were going to get into an industry where they will be, you know, the next Jordan or whoever it is. And most, you know, the vast majority don't. But, you know, ironically, that's quite similar to journalism. And it was a very, very, you know, a lot of people have fallen out of the industry because it's just collapsed, basically.
Yeah. Let's talk about conservatism, because your book is very much it's a sort of part memoir, but and also part self-deprecating defense of conservatism and its ideas. And I often ask people when we're talking about whatever position they're coming from, you know, what is it that you wish other people understood, whether that's, you know, about race or Christianity or Islam or trans issues or whatever it is. And it feels to me like you've written a whole book trying to kind of explain what it is that you as a conservative believe, with a very careful ear for all of the misconceptions and the preconceptions about it and the sort of cultural gloss of progressivism. But what really stuck out to me is I don't think till I read it I would have been able to define exactly what conservatism is, as opposed to neoliberalism or free market economics or traditionalism or orthodoxy or all these kind of adjacent things. And one of the things you say is that it's a good pitch with bad messengers. I'd love you to just say, what is the pitch? How do you define it?
I mean, I mentioned this, but one of the reasons there's no stand-up comedians who are conservative, or very few, is that the message is very hard to get in a soundbite, and it's kind of counterintuitive, so it's not immediately obvious. But I suppose one would define it as, I mean, it's a particular vision of human nature. I mean, so it's the idea that humans are limited. Humans are naturally flawed people. So any kind of political system that assumes humans are naturally good is going to end up causing more misery. And it's very, and that sounds like a very depressive and sort of, you know, misanthropic vision, but it's not saying humans are bad. In fact, it's, you can even say the vast majority of humans are good, but it takes only a very small number of bad people to make life a misery for everyone. So you have to recognize that. So, you know, I mentioned Rousseau, who I think is, you know, the wrongest person in history, because I thought his vision, his ideas were very common, especially when I was growing up, that, you know, humans are sort of naturally good, and it's any institutions that make us, you know, behave in this monstrous way. But I mean, conservatism is the opposite idea, and it's institutions, in fact, that make life bearable for us. And conservatism, you know, the original is a French word, and in the context of France and England, it meant people who supported the church and the crown. And obviously, in the American interpretation, that's slightly different because there's no church and no crown. But it means supporting existing institutions because through them you have sort of legitimacy, and then through legitimacy you have law. And you have that moderating influence on people, and that and basically, you know, institutions, the limits of people's behavior. But it would also be a certain parochialism. It's of conservatism is against universalism, in the sense that, you know, the liberal idea is that, you know, we are the world, going back to Thomas Paine, that, you know, all people can basically live under the same system. All people can have this new sort of, you know, modern framework of government be fine. Well, the conservatives would say, actually, different people, because of the historical traditions, something might work in one country, something might work in another. I mean, that's why in recent times, you know, the Iraq war was probably like the most insanely unconservative thing in principle. You don't sort of tear up institutions without knowing what will replace them. That it's also, conservatism is naturally inclined towards the familiar and the local as opposed to universal. So it's okay to favor the family members, it's okay to favor your own compatriots over other people. It doesn't mean you hate the local, the other people. It's that's a sort of natural human
I guess it's an instinct against the kind of universalizing.
Yeah, so you know, it's good. I mean, like, you know, conservatives say a nation state is good. It's good to be patriotic. It's good to favor your own country against others, you know, in preference to them, maybe. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's obviously come under particular sort of disfavor in recent years. It seems either immoral in one sense, or just sort of, you know, I refer to these ideas being sort of low status. So if you want to signal how clever or educated you are, you sort of denigrate your country to show that you travel the world and, you know, you're very open-minded, educated people. But I think there's nothing wrong with that, to be to love your country or to want to put it first.
There's also a theme I think that came out about a kind of orientation in time, which you really helped me understand, and you quote Roger Scruton saying conservatism is the politics of delay. And then someone else whose name I can't remember, which was about standing athwart history, shouting stop. It's the sort of the opposite of what C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery, isn't it? It's looking back and saying that things that have stood the test of time have legitimacy, and not assuming that we know more than people in the past, or we're better people than people in the past, and therefore we can build a better world. And that seems to me to be really fundamental, because it's so deeply imbued in our imagination, this sense of progress towards something better, whether that's kind of technological progress or industrialization or a Christian understanding of telos, that it is actually quite a radical, counterintuitive position to say, no, the past was better.
Yeah, well, if something is, yeah, there's the argument, if something is stood the test of time, then that's a sort of proof in itself. There is, and before you go around changing it, and obviously, you know, the 20th century was sort of less than now. There are all sorts of radical ideas to start anew, and in most cases, they caused huge amounts of misery. So, yeah, you know, sort of, so liberals believe in freedom and socialists believe in equality. And I suppose conservatives would want limits on both of those to some extent as well. That was another thing. Because conservatives don't really believe in human equality, and that also sounds really appalling since it's become a sort of sacred value now. Another thing which makes us sound, you know, very unpopular in the modern world, unintelligent.
Why do you not believe in human equality? Like, unpack it for me, because you're right, it lands badly, and I want to understand the best form of that argument.
I mean, we don't believe in equality of outcomes. It's just conservatives just believe naturally that that's just impossible to acquire, because people have different abilities, different inclinations. And the sort of the pursuit of quality of outcomes is a sort of from a milder version of that sort of utopian tradition of let's sort of try to fix society so it seems fair, when the conservatives just say, well, you know, life is unfair. Some people are sort of, you know, born either better looking or whatever, or smarter, or all these other unfair things, and you have to sort of find comfort in the fact that, you know, it's never going to be achieved.
Yeah, it felt to me, it was a really helpful picture, because it felt to me, and I come to the conclusion about a lot of things on this, whether it's kind of theological leanings or aesthetic preferences, that much more is down to temperament than we like to think. You know, that of course we're rational beings, of course we're looking at evidence and arguments a bit, but actually sometimes it's just the things that we're temperamentally drawn to, which you clearly are. Tell me, I often ask religious believers if they've had a crisis of faith. I want to ask you, you know, has your conservatism ever had a crisis of faith? Not least because you're quite funny on how this has there's a social stigma about being conservative, at least where you live and in journalism and in the kind of circles you've been in.
Brexit, basically. I mean, I thought Brexit was a little bit, because I thought it was the first big moment when I was a supporter, and then I sort of worked for a Leave MP, and I read loads and loads about the subject to a huge degree, to a sort of tedious degree, and I realised actually I was in that sort of sweet spot, or the opposite of a sweet spot, which I suppose uncanny valley, where I knew a lot about a subject which made me sort of dangerously knowledgeable, but without knowing enough that I could actually see the details of it. And I came away thinking this is going to be really complex and quite a bad thing overall. That was an issue where I just thought, actually, we've got it wrong here. A big issue, that was sort of a big conservative crisis of faith. And that sort of comes towards the end of the story, really, because, I mean, that's where it wraps up. And it's sort of ongoing, isn't it? I mean, it's going to go on forever, probably.
Yeah.
But it's also a thing to actually, it has a biological hormonal effect on you when you, you know, wake up, realize actually I might have got something massively wrong, and my entire belief system based on this is probably flawed. It's not like a joyful thing. It's the opposite. It's kind of like a sinking feeling. You think, oh, God. So maybe that'll turn out all right in the end, but it's, but I don't know, maybe everyone should have like a crisis of faith, right? I mean, maybe it's a healthy thing, maybe it's a good thing. It makes you grow as a person.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have an open mind in order to let that happen, I think. And the argument you're making is that even though, you know, Boris Johnson won the last election on an absolute landslide, that the trajectory, the direction of travel of our culture is to kind of greater and greater progressivism. And you talk about the kind of cultural capture of major institutions and this sense in which, you know, anyone who's smart, anyone who's informed, anyone who's kind will of course be progressive, will of course be on the left. Just kind of narrate how that's come about. Where do you think that's come from, and why you still think that's the case, given that a lot of people feel like maybe the pendulum's swinging back the other way?
Partly if you just look at elections now, young people did used to vote for conservative, and now in overwhelming numbers they vote for left-wing parties, but that's the very young. Amongst people sort of my age, I'm early 40s now, about 10 years earlier they would massively moved to the right by this stage, because you have kids and you move to the suburbs and you know, become a grumpy middle-aged man and whatever. That generational shift has not really happened either in Britain or America amongst those born from the late 1970s, early 80s. People now still identifying as being on the left, whether it's, you know, radical left or sort of centre left. There is a sort of an actual change going on. People, educated people born after a certain year really find conservatism really repulsive. I mean, and it is a class thing. It is, you know, people from the professions used to be very mixed, and now they are overwhelmingly left of centre. You know, we think of academia as being a sort of, you know, it's obviously left wing thing, but in the 60s, you know, 35% of academics in Britain voted Tory, about a similar number voted Republican. And now, you know, it's something like 10 or 15 to 1, and the amongst the right wing ones would be much older. So the people coming in to replace them are overwhelmingly, overwhelmingly left wing. And in social sciences, you know, vast gap. I mean, Harvard did their latest study. It said 1% of their academics, I think, are Republicans now. So, but it's not just academia. In teaching, in medicine, at least in the States, used to be very right-leaning profession. Now it's overwhelmingly left-leaning. You know, science, overwhelmingly, it's become, in all these professions, there has become the sort of left-wing dominance. And so all the major institutions, you know, the sort of, the deep state, you might want to call it, who sort of run Britain, even if the Tories come into power, they're still overwhelmingly run by people on the left. So, I mean, this was when the book was first, you know, first pitched, a couple of publishers who turned down said, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, what about Trump's in power and, you know, Brexit? But, you know, Brexit is a very, very much done, supported by older people. Young people, you know, as some Remainers have gleefully said, similar thing, Trump voters, I mean, Trump didn't win the majority, but, you know, his voters tend to be older and poorer. And, you know, just styles and fashions tend to come from above, you know, historically. So, I mean, I use the historical analogy of religions. You know, religions that are practiced by dominant sort of overclasses in societies become adopted by everyone eventually, because everyone wants to follow the people above them. And that's happened in, you know, lots of, you know, so historically Protestantism in England starts off as very much a minority, an educated elite minority pursuit. And, you know, within a couple of generations, it became the overwhelming majority religion. And Catholicism was just practiced by a few aristos and rural people in remote areas. And that's the sort of trajectory that the right is going. And I do also, you know, I mentioned the biggest factor, which is religion. We know when religion declines, politics becomes religion. So the sort of liberal left has become the replacement religion for people. So, you know, people need a moral anchor. And where it once would have been the churches, now it's sort of the left, basically. So if you meet someone under 45 and they're not, and they're sort of very, you know, decent, compassionate person, and if they're not religious, you can pretty much guess they're going to be on the left. If they're religious, it could go either way, but probably more likely to be on the right.
There's so much I want to talk to you about that, because we have kind of fascinating sets of data around that. But I'm going to park it for the sake of time, and because the theme that really struck with me is the way you unpack the way the class allegiances have really shifted. That, you know, if we think of Labour emerging out of a working class movement, a very much non-elite, those disenfranchised from power, and conservatism tending to be those who had the stake in institutions, you know, who had assets, for whom stability was really, you know, for obvious and understandable reasons, more attractive. But we've seen this massive flip, and really quite recently, I think, from and we still use the language as if, you know, the elites or the institutions are on the right. But your argument is that you're seeing much more working class conservatism emerging and a much more elite progressivism sort of taking the place of that working class. What do you think why do you think that's happened? And two, what do you think the effects of it are on the way we engage across these differences?
I think, yeah, I mean, it's known as the Great Realignment. That's the thing. And it started in the States slightly earlier, starting in the 60s. And that's when you first get the sort of populist language on the right about coastal elites. I mean, in Britain, it also in the 60s, is a bit of a shift. So British class politics in 1945, the overwhelming majority of working class people voted Labour, and the overwhelming majority of middle class people voted Tory. It was very much in class lines. And that shifted quite a lot in the late 60s, the permissive society. So more, you know, liberal middle class people went to left and vice versa. But it's only recently, yes, in the last two elections, it's actually the Tories have won the majority of working class voters. It's sort of, it's a reversion to pre-industrial politics, which makes sort of more sense. You know, in the industrial era, as you say, it's, you have sort of big class reasons to go along. But before then, you know, we had a liberal merchant left, the Whigs, who were supported by the, you know, very urban and were, you know, the Liberal Party's forerunners. And then you had the sort of more rural-based Tories who are more conservative and actually much more popular amongst, you know, outside the cities. And so that's kind of a reversion to that norm, which sort of is historically makes more sense because people in cities are more liberal. And that's found everywhere, really. The more urban density you have, the more liberal people's values are, just because it's a sort of adaptation. So where the left goes, it's different. It's difficult to know because it's a sort of alliance between liberals who, you know, aren't particularly big on redistribution and taxes and sort of more radicals. So there's sort of two blocks. At the moment, you know, the left has done badly because they can't unite those sort of two blocks in one party. They've always had trouble. And that's partly because of sort of the, and this again is where, you know, I think the left is more like religion, the need for purity. Amongst, you know, they need to be much more creedal, and that's why the left, you know, is finding it more difficult to sort of make these alliances between people, because, you know, you need to follow the creed, otherwise you're not really, you know, one of us. But, you know, that might change. They might be able to, you know, reform and win the next election. Who knows?
I tend to ask guests to share what they've learnt about engaging across the differences that they, you know, the kind of fault lines that they sit on, and you're very funny about going to North London dinner parties. I mean, I think it's particularly interesting for you as a conservative living and working in very liberal environments. And I get the impression that a lot of the time you just kept very quiet about what you believe politically. But where you have engaged and you've had these conversations across differences, what has helped? And if there's one thing you would like those who are liberal or progressive to understand about conservatism that you think they repeatedly get wrong, what would that be?
I think the one thing people, and I mean, this is what Jonathan Haidt found in their surveys, that most liberals, people identify as very liberal, don't understand that conservatives, you know, have the same beliefs and values as them. I mean, they share almost all their values. You know, so the classic one was that people with very liberal ideas misunderstood that most conservatives, the overwhelming conservatives, would strongly object to being cruel to defenseless animals. Like, obviously we would. But because just because something might not be a priority, or because it might be countered by some other factor, it doesn't mean it's, you know, important. So, you know, all the, basically, if you think that something is a social problem and you're in the left, most conservatives will agree with you, but they will either find it a social problem that can't be fixed, or there will be a sort of unintended consequence of dealing with it, such and such, or it will counter against some other social value. And, you know, and the best policy comes about from accepting that there are no solutions, there are only two, you know, bad outcomes, and you have to sort of find which is the least bad. That's on a sort of very basic level. I mean, you know, I don't want to generalize, because lots of people do understand the conservative mindset. And, you know, some people just have different values. So I'm not trying to necessarily say to someone, you know, you're wrong. I mean, I suppose partly it's just saying, listen, just at least understand where we're coming from. It doesn't mean we're evil. I mean, some of us are evil. But we just, you know, see the world in a different way to you. And I think it's part of the problem with, I don't know, modern living, is that it's much easier now to go about your life and never really meeting anyone who's that different to you. I mean, you know, I take an example of, you know, where my mum lives in a town of 20,000 people. all the people she knows come from very different backgrounds. They have very different political views. They have different education levels, because it's just that's who you live with. You've got no choice. And that's how it's been for most people. Now, people are much more likely to be, amazingly live in this diverse city with 20 different restaurants, cuisines, people from all over the world. But all your neighbors have exactly the same education levels. They all have exactly the same political views as you. I mean, they've all been selected in that way. So it's much easier to, never meet anyone who differs from you in any sort of fundamental, significant or interesting way. And I suppose that is partly who the book's aimed at.
Thanks, Ed. That is a good summing up of why I love having these conversations, because I learn such a lot about myself as well as the people that I'm listening to. Ed, thank you so much for talking to me on The Sacred.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Soup Shop Productions, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at @sacred_podcast, or me at @TheosElizabeth, or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.